Welcome, everybody. Thanks for joining us. We're going to get started here. I do want to give you a quick heads up. I'm not sure if the text went out late or what, but the calls and questions are really light right now. We may only be doing an hour, but I can tell you if you want to get through, now is your chance. If you press one on your phone with a question, a comment, a topic, I guarantee you we'll get to you. If we get enough questions, we'll do 2 hours. If not, we'll do one, and I'll get to as many as I can. So let's go ahead and get started.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business and Beyond, the show that puts the money where it belongs,
back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers, the list goes on and on. If you've got a question about anything at all, we'll tackle it here on this show. All you have to do is pick up the phone and ask your question. We're going to get to those in just a little bit. I've been harping on you about the fact that it's tax time. The single most important thing you can do to pay the least amount of tax and get the best return is to get in early. The second biggest thing you can do is make sure that you have a tax preparer who really understands the trucking industry so you're getting all your deductions and they're being handled correctly, especially per diem and depreciation. And the third is making sure you are taking advantage of all the tax deductions available. Now, one of the things I hear people say all the time, and it kind of drives me nuts, when they buy stuff, chrome, that doesn't have any real return. It's not an investment of any kind. It's not going to improve the bottom line. In fact, it makes the bottom line worse. You're just spending money. And I hear people justifying it by saying, well, it's tax. It's true. If you buy chrome, yeah, you can throw it under maintenance, take it off as a tax deduction. But I don't think people understand what that really means. They feel like if they spent a dollar on chrome or $1,000 on chrome, that it's going to lower their tax bill by $1,000. That's not true. Even when we say an item is 100% deductible, that doesn't mean it saves that amount in tax. The way taxes work is a deduction comes off of the gross revenue before you pay tax. It doesn't come off of the tax. So $1,000 that comes off your gross revenue, whether it was whatever expense it was, if it was deductible as a business expense, for example, chrome, you spend $1,000 on chrome, the $1,000 gone, it's only going to lower your tax bill by about $300. So you've still spent $700 on something that doesn't give you a return at all. Now, if you like chrome and you want to go buy some, go buy it. And know that, yeah, it's not costing you full face value because you are getting a tax deduction for it. But just be aware of how that works. Most people really have that wrong. Now, what you would be much better off doing is taking tax deductions in areas you're already spending the money and you're not getting a deduction for it. And I want to go through some of those. Now, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail here. I do this in some of my seminars. I do it at the CMC, and I spend about an hour and a half on all of the deductions like these that you could be taking. I'm going to go through a couple here. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail. I am going to be doing a webinar on this soon, and I'll take as much time as I need to on the webinar. So if you're on our mailing list, you'll get a notice when that gets finished and it goes out. If you're not on our mailing list, go get on our mailing list. And it's real simple. Just go to the website, letstruck.com, and on the bottom left, you'll see a sign up for our newsletter, and we'll get those kind of updates out to you. So let's talk about some things you're already spending money on, but you are not getting a deduction. And one of them, very, very common, is personal vehicle miles. The IRS allows you to take a deduction for the mileage you put on your personal vehicle for business reasons. Now, they would allow you to take expenses if you kept receipts and all that, but I'm going to tell you not to. The IRS gives us an allowance, and it's very generous. It is more than what you will spend, and you don't have to keep all the records. All you need to do is keep a log of when you use the vehicle for business reasons, and technically you should keep a log when you're using it personal as well, but if you just keep track of total miles for the year and then have a log entry for every time you use it for business. So use an app on your phone. There are tons of them. Keep a little notebook in your car with a pen and a little notebook would be just fine. And if you get in the car and you're saying, oh, you know, I got to stop at the bank and deposit a settlement, or I have to stop at the bank and whatever, if it's business, I have to stop at the parts store and pick up some oil. I have to go to the grocery store, but while I'm there, I'm going to get some office supplies as well. Or I'm going to the grocery store, and on the way back, I'm going to stop at the office store. All of those scenarios are deductible business trips. So on your little notebook that day, you would just write down the date, the reason for the trip, office supplies, and the number of miles, 32 miles. The IRS is going to give you a deduction for those miles. You don't have to keep the receipts or anything. Now, if you're using our software, Profit Gauges, you don't have to know any of what the deductions are, any of that stuff. All you do every month when you put in your records in our software, you just put the number of miles you put on your personal vehicle that month, and we will calculate the deduction for you. So that's a big one. Again, I'm not going to go into a lot of detail right now, but start taking it. You're already spending the money. Get the deduction. That's the kind of stuff we want to look for. You could be paying your children, and this turns out to be a very large deduction for some people. This one is a little more complicated, a couple more hoops you have to jump through. Nothing major, but too much for me to go into a lot of detail here. But I will tell you that your children, stepchildren, foster children, adopted children, and grandchildren, you can pay them to work in your business, and they get treated different than other employees, and it makes it very lucrative to do this. You're not going to have to withhold taxes from them, and you're not going to have to pay Social Security and Medicare. The money that the business pays to them is 100% tax deductible to the business, and if we set this up and do it right, the child will pay no tax. This is a true win-win-win all the way around. The other thing it does is now it allows your child to contribute to a retirement account. So they could contribute to a Roth and start setting up their retirement tax-free at a very early age. It's an amazing gift you can give to your child. Now, the child truly should be working in the business with you, which I think is another plus. They'll learn responsibility. It's time you get to spend with them. Not going to go into a lot of detail. I will in the webinar, but just know that this is a deduction you should be taking, but you need to understand it. The next one are vacations. Vacations, when you own a business, as long as they're within the country, should always be tax deductible, because all you have to do is include a little bit of business each day on your vacation, and then all of your expenses, virtually all of your expenses, become tax deductible. Travel to and from the destination, whether it's car, train, plane, hotels, meals, rental cars, you name it. So you could go out in the morning and make a sales call or go look at a truck, and then you could spend the rest of the day at the golf course, the beach, the mountain, skiing, an amusement park, whatever, and the expenses for that day are deductible. Every day that you do business, you get to deduct all the expenses. If you only did business one day on a two-week trip, you would still get your airfare or your travel back and forth. This is another great deduction. There are a couple things you've got to follow, a couple rules you need, and I don't have enough time on this show to go into all the details. Those are just a couple of the things that I see people are not taking as deductions that could save many owner-operators thousands of dollars in tax. Now, if you don't want to wait for the webinar, just call us, because we do these on our tax returns. We'll help you out with it. We'll tell you what you need to do. Give us a call, 855-800-FUEL. We'll make sure you get the best tax return possible. Stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right to the phones. We're going to head off to Georgia this time. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to kind of give you an update on my progress. I want to thank you so much for the information that you put out here for the drivers. And to make a long story short, and I don't mean to take up much of the time, but I was in a terrible, when I mean terrible, it was a terrible lease program that I was in. And I won't say the name of the company, but they are on the east side of Chattanooga. But at the end of the day, I was only making 13 cents a mile at net profit at the end of the day, running 115,000 miles a year. And I remember listening to you and taking in the things that you would say, and one of the biggest thing that helped me get through the lease program was knowing my numbers, putting my numbers in profit gauges, and it's showing me what's available and what's not available. And that is the single biggest thing that really got me through this lease program. And last year, about around June, at the end of June, the little money that I was making, I was able to pay my truck off. And once I paid my truck off, I called you and you congratulated me on paying my truck off, but at the same time, I was still nervous about the transition of going over to Landstar. And one of the things that you told me that really stuck with me, you said that just take a deep breath, it's going to get easier. You said as long as I continue to keep doing what I'm doing, tracking my numbers, keep my fuel costs down, keep my maintenance down, you said it will get easier for me. And one of the books that you also recommend that me read about customer service his book on Zig Ziglar, and I began to start listening to every book that Zig Ziglar had got out on, you know, the books that Zig Ziglar got out, and I began to listen to it and began to up my game in my customer service. And so by me being over here with Landstar, I began to start doing that. I began to call, you know, just simple calling the broker. I made it at the shipper. Okay, I done picked up the load, and I beat my ETA to the delivery at this time. And I went a step farther than that, was to email the broker a copy of the bill of lading. Okay, now this one particular broker I did a load for, she told me, you know, she didn't say nothing in the beginning, but the second time I booked the load for her, I did the same thing, and she stopped. She says, "Are you the only one that does this?" And I told her, I said, "No, ma'am, I do this for all of my brokers. You know, every load that I get." And so,
right.
to make a long story short, because of me doing that, it caused me to be in a dedicated run with a major beverage company all over the world. I have zero deadhead miles. I'm home every other day, and I'm home on weekends. And, Kevin, I'm going to be honest with you. I have never in my life cleared, net, brought home a $2,800 check. And, Kevin, I got to say,
wow,
thank you so much for giving me the information that I needed so that I could go out and do the job. And I just wanted to give you a progress report on what's going on with me.
Wow.
I really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for calling and giving me that, because you just made my day. And you certainly don't need to apologize for taking up time, because this is what this show is all about. This is what I wake up for. This is what gets me going every day, is knowing that there are people out there like you that want to succeed. They're willing to do whatever it takes to succeed. They just need a little bump in the right direction. And that was all I gave you. I gave you a little bump, pointed out a couple things you might do, some things to listen to, and you took off running with it. And we need lots more people like you in the industry. So when we get a chance to share stories like this on the air, it really makes my day, because there are other people listening right now that are going to look to you as an inspiration and an example. So thank you for doing the hard work.
I really do appreciate it. And to be honest with you, I got my goals. I got my plans set. As far to my next thing is now is purchasing me a trailer. And I'm on track within maybe a year. I have my trailer purchased and paid for. And I appreciate it again, Kevin.
You are so very welcome. Keep doing what you do. We need more people like you, and we need more examples like you. I absolutely love that. Those mornings, I get up early and work, really early. Some mornings about 3:30. This morning I slept in till 4:15. Some of those mornings I don't really feel like getting out of bed and working. But I know I get my best work done in the morning with no distractions. But on those mornings where I don't feel like getting up and reading or recording or writing or doing all the other things I do every day, I think of people like Steve. And that gets me going and gets me out of bed. I love it. Let's go to Montana. Fred, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. There's been a lot of talk about ELDs lately, and I'd just like to share with everybody, I've started using an ELD app on my smartphone, and I run Team with my wife, and she uses her log on the tablet. And I'll tell you, this thing is great. The app is called Big Load, and you can edit it. It's whatever you're doing on loose leaf log, you can do the same thing with this app. The only thing is, when the mandates come in effect, I believe it's the end of December 2017 or January 2018, you will have to have a data link where it reads the ECM, takes your mileages, and it knows when the truck is moving. Now, the beauty of this is it knows your location, so you don't even have to enter the city or town you're in. And I'll tell you, you cannot write out a log fast enough once you get onto this. And I'd just like to share this with the listeners, because that guy that called in a couple of weekends ago saying that ELDs was going to put him out of business, and he just openly admitted on the air, well, he falsifies his logs. That's the whole reason why the government is forcing people to do this, you know? And
yeah,
why,
you know,
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say I completely agree, and I was talking about this 10 years ago when people first started hearing about ELDs, and I heard guys say, well, I'm going to get out of the industry. And I tried to convince them then, look, your problem isn't with ELDs. Your problem is with the hours of service. You're just cheating right now. If you think the ELDs are going to cost you that much money, it could only mean that you're cheating, which, is, you know, I get it. I was out there. I did it too. But then I stopped doing it, and I learned how to manage my time and changed my operations so that hours of service weren't a problem anymore. That's what I've been trying to convince people to do. So thank you for calling in with an app like this. I've been encouraging people, get something like this and start running right now. We absolutely have a date now. You know this is coming. So you have 2 years to figure out how you're going to run your business under ELDs and make money doing it. So you better start now.
Yeah, that's what I told my boss, and he was ecstatic over the idea. We have like 50 trucks, and right now it's voluntary. He wants, he's hoping that the whole fleet will gradually switch over by the end of the year, and he agrees. You got two years to work on your time management and figure out how to make it work for you, and it's coming. You know, you might as well get used to it, but I'm telling you, once you get onto it, it is a breeze. And I'd like to make a comment about biodiesel. I've been trying to get in. I always get disconnected out of service. But
sure.
What I've been finding, I avoid biodiesel, especially the B20. Like, if you're ever pumping the fuel and you see it, the B20 is like dirty cooking oil or whatever. If I'm at a place and it has that, I'll only put 50 gallons in and move on. And I have no scientific proof of this, but because it's a team truck, our truck never idles, and it's got one of those emission motors. But while we were on vacation, I had our shop that said, you know, rather than waiting for my DPF to plug up while we're on the road, let's get it clean while we're on vacation. And when they took it apart, our head mechanic says, he's never seen one this clean. He says, whatever you're doing, keep doing it. So because our truck doesn't idle, and I feel that kind of fuel, there's doesn't have enough BTUs in it. And just
hey,
like you were
hold that thought. I'm gonna have to get to a break. Music play it. We're gonna be right back. Stick around. I'm Kevin Rothberg. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're going to get right back to the calls. I was talking with Fred in Montana. Fred, go ahead.
Yeah, about the biodiesel. So anyways, when they took the particulate filter apart, it was clean. And it had 400,000 miles on it. He says, I've never seen anything this clean. It didn't even need it, but they still did it. And so my theory is that if the fuel's not burning hot enough, how can it burn all the particulate matter? And I just wonder what you thought of that, especially when you were talking about a caller that said that when drivers haul biodiesel, they don't have to placard the load because of a low flash point. Well, that just kind of my theory that if you have a high percentage of biodiesel, how can you get energy? Because it obviously has a lower BTU, which would you not agree?
Yeah, I completely agree. And I've said for years that I just don't really get the whole biodiesel thing. And the other problem I have with it is the quality seems to be all over the board. Some people say they get some and they like it, but that's pretty rare. Most people have learned over the years to avoid it. We know it can clog filters more often. I think you're absolutely right, and I don't have scientific proof either, but I think anything we run through that engine that isn't burning hot and burning completely is going to clog the DPF. That's just logical. The hotter and cleaner we burn fuel, the less particulate there is, and it is a diesel particulate filter. So the more particulate, the more it's going to clog up, the more problems you're going to have. Your performance is going to suffer. Your fuel economy is going to suffer. So I think what you're doing, avoiding the biodiesel and not idling, is absolutely a great thing for the DPF. Thanks for the call and the heads up on that. Let's head off to Alabama. Bill, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call.
Can I help you out?
Hey, I've got a 94 Detroit and a 2000 Freightliner Classic. And I recently had the boost sensor go out and had it replaced at the dealership. And that really caused them a lot of problems. They spent like 15 hours on it trying to get it to calibrate right. But my question is, I got a scan gauge back at Christmas, and it says I'm only getting about 370 max horsepower under, you know, full throttle out of it. And my mileage is off a bit. I mean, it's better now that I can see it on the scan gauge because I'm better monitoring it. But I used to get 7 easy out of this truck, and I've got to push it to get 6.8 out of it now.
Okay, so I've got two answers for you here. On the horsepower, you either have to go calibrate this in the scan gauge or ignore the number and just use it as a reference. What I mean by that is that the scan gauge can't measure horsepower because the ECM can't measure horsepower. All it can do is guess at what the horsepower is. We need a mechanical device like a dyno to truly measure how much force, how much torque and horsepower is being applied in the real world. Anything that comes out of the ECM is a guess. The computer is just saying there's this much boost, there's this much fuel, the RPMs are here, so we're going to calculate that it's power. Now, what you can do, and I don't recommend it, it's just not worth it, but you could put the truck on a dyno and then program the scan gauge to match it. So you figure out at this RPM, you know, this gear, here's our horsepower, and then you can get the scan gauge to match that. In my opinion, it's just not worth it. What you can do, though, is say, okay, I've used the scan gauge, and on the hardest pull, full throttle, the scan gauge shows 370. So what I want to do is see if I can get up that hill with only 300 instead. The numbers don't have to be accurate in order to teach us something and tell us what's working and what isn't. And the idea behind horsepower is it's nice to have a lot of it, but the less of it we use, the better fuel economy we're going to get, the longer our tires are going to last, our driveline's going to hold up better, clutches, everything. So just use it as a reference. You know what your max is. Play around with trying to either get, you know, accelerate with less horsepower, get up the hills with less horsepower, that kind of thing. Fuel economy, again, the ECM, the skin gauge, all the skin gauge does is read the ECM and put the information in a format that you can understand. The ECM can't calculate fuel economy. It can't measure it. It can calculate it. It can't measure it. Because there's nothing on the truck that actually measures fuel flow. So again, any fuel mileage coming out of the ECM is just a guess by the computer. Same thing, though, we use it as a reference. If we go up a hill one way and we get 6.7 miles to the gallon, and then we try that hill again and we get 7.2 miles to the gallon because we shifted different, we know we made an improvement. But we always use a program like Fuel Gauges to calculate real fuel mileage based on gallons and miles. So we always recommend using the two together.
And it's been pretty accurate, really. It has.
Well, good. Good. Sometimes they are. Sometimes they're way off. I've seen ECMs that are 3 miles to the gallon off. They're so bad. And I've seen some...
Wow.
I've seen some that always land within 2 or 3 tenths, which is pretty accurate.
Yeah, I do mine on every tank manually and check it against the skin gauge, and it's been right there. I've really hadn't had a problem with that.
Good, good. Well, then, I'm not sure what the problem might have been with that boost sensor. That's a DDEC 2. Not many guys around that have a lot of experience working on those. It's a great engine, though. Let's go to Brooklyn. John, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How are you doing today?
Good. What's on your mind?
I wanted to mention something that I haven't heard on the show before. Kind of a maintenance tip / business tip. I ran into a driver today in Brooklyn that... He lost his phone in a snowbank, and he was asking to borrow my phone, and obviously I lent it to him and was helping him out, and his truck was broken down. And I did everything that I could, but I felt bad in the end because I ultimately had to go. My load was ready, and I needed to move, and I needed to go, and I couldn't help him out with my phone anymore. And it got me thinking that other drivers should kind of maybe think about what I've thought about. I always worry about my phone being lost, stolen, broken, whatever, forgetting it someplace. I always keep a burner phone on the truck, a burner phone and a card. And if for some reason my phone doesn't work or I lose it, I'm never without a phone. And this business without a phone is near impossible. And it only costs you $20 to buy a burner phone and another $40 for a card, and they're good forever.
That's a great idea. That really is. I like that one a lot, and I hadn't really thought about that one before.
I'm going to mention one more thing, too, though.
Go ahead.
You have to make sure that you program all of your phone numbers that you need into that burner phone, because... I don't remember phone numbers anymore. You and I both grew up in the area. I remember everybody's phone number from when I was a teenager. I still remember those phone numbers. But today,
give
me somebody's phone number, I don't remember it because it's in the phone. The phone dials it all the time. So make sure if you do this, people, to program them into the phone first.
Yeah. Or, you know what, if you don't want to take the time to program it into the phone, if you have a way of printing out your contact list, just throw a hard copy in the truck somewhere. But you're right. Make sure you have those because I don't know anybody's phone number anymore. It is so bad.
Think of that as a tool. It's an excellent tool that I think people forget.
Yeah, I love the idea. I was even thinking as you were saying it, I was going to do it here on the coach, but maybe I will. Just because $60 is so cheap, just throw it someplace and forget about it till, you know, someday where I might need it. Most of the time, Lisa and I are traveling together, so we usually have two phones. And I haven't lost mine yet, but it's you know, it's bound to happen. Something's going to happen, and you're right. Having that backup phone, you would be smiling when you knew you were, you know, good
to
go with another phone.
Man, that's cheap.
Yeah, exactly. Hey, there's the music. I've got to get to a break. I love those kind of tips. We'll be right back. Stick around. Kevin Rutherford. All right, so a quick heads up, we're going to head into the fourth segment of the first hour. So at the end, I'll say goodnight, goodbye, all that stuff. Don't hang up. Let me check questions real quick. Looks like we are going to come back and do another hour, and you might be able to get in. If you press 1 on your phone right now, I might be able to get to you in the second hour. So don't hang up after this. Here we go. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. Let's head off to Illinois. John, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. I'm getting a new family doctor because I just moved 100 miles away from where I grew up. And I want to try to – I got some pre-existing stuff that needs to be watched over. What would you suggest? I'm going to talk to the doctor about the ketogenic diet. If he doesn't know about it, which one of your books or which one of the books that you have read would you recommend to a doctor to understand the ketogenic diet?
Yeah, good question. And I'm glad that you're thinking about this and you want to make the recommendation to him. And hopefully you find a doctor who will be open to that. So you're being very proactive, and that's good. For a doctor, I would definitely recommend Keto Clarity by Jimmy Moore. Okay. The biggest reason is I'm probably going to get the exact number wrong, but there was like 18 doctors or something that contributed to that book. There were medical researchers, doctors, PhDs. So I think just that fact alone would add a lot of credibility for a doctor reading it. Doctors can tend to be a little arrogant about their education, and if they are reading something from somebody who doesn't have a medical degree or a PhD. So this book is really short pieces and chapters from lots of different doctors and researchers with really strong credentials. So you would have a hard time discounting, you know, their credentials. So I think that would be the best book for a doctor.
I was kind of pushing towards the Green Brain, but I suppose it does make sense with you coming across as all the supporting doctors behind Keto Clarity.
You know, both Grain Brain and Wheat Belly are excellent books written by doctors with amazing credentials. They're both a little more difficult. They're longer, less likely that somebody's going to read one all the way through. And they don't necessarily focus on a ketogenic diet. They are, you know, grain-free, but you could be grain-free and not necessarily ketogenic. You could be paleo. And, you know, another great book, the problem is not written by a doctor. She's a nutritional therapy practitioner, is Eat the Oaks. But I, again, it's a little more paleo than it is ketogenic, and it doesn't have the science behind it the way Keto Clarity does.
Okay. That was kind of, I just got done reading that book. It's very interesting. I was just kind of wishy-washy on which way to go on that. Figured I'd just ask your opinion. So thank you very much for that, Kevin.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call. Yeah, you know, I need to correct that. I said Eat the Yolks doesn't have the science behind it, and that's not true. It does have the science behind it. She doesn't necessarily have the medical credentials. I'd like her credentials. I think the book was amazing. But if you want to get across to a doctor really good information about a ketogenic diet, I think Keto Clarity is definitely my top choice. There are a couple others out there, but I would go with that one. Let's see. We're going to get back to the phones. We're off to Ohio. Herschel, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. How you doing?
Doing great. What can I help you with today?
Well, I've talked to you before. I got a statement and then a question. My quick statement that I just found unbelievable, but it's working like a champion. You know that I've talked to you about regularity issues.
Yeah.
I was talking to our now mutual buddy, John, and described everything to him, and he says, "You're drinking too much." I said, "What do you mean, John?" So he went through it, and he explained to me how everything works, so I cut my total liquid intake for the day down to 35 to 40 ounces, and I haven't missed a day yet. Unbelievable.
Outstanding. That's fantastic.
Yeah, my regular doc gave me stuff for IBS, gave me stuff for acid reducers, you name it, done them all. And all I had to do is not drink so much. Wow. But anyway, because I was drinking,
yeah.
I was drinking a good gallon every day.
Yeah.
Of water. My question for you today is, tomorrow I have an appointment with an NTP down in Cincinnati.
Okay.
And I know you said to make sure you get somebody that understands the ketogenic, which I'll find that out first thing when I get there. But what else should I try to get from her? What do you think I should be asking? What do you think?
You know, I think you know enough about this. I've talked to you many times. You ask good questions here. You're reading things. You're learning things. I think that it's not as important what specific questions you ask. I think it's going to be more of a, I hate to use the word feeling, more of a gut instinct about whether or not it feels like a good fit for you or not. You know, I could give you some specific questions, and she may be great at answering them, but I really think that this relationship is more important that it feels right, that you're comfortable and, you know, you're able to talk and work towards goals together. So I don't know that you need to be too concerned about specific questions. I just think if you sit down, if you like the way, you know, her interview style, one of the things they actually teach in the NTP program is interview style. And there's a great book we read on it, and we, you know, we do some work when we're in person on it. But not everybody picks up on it. Some people are just really bad at good communication. So even if I gave you some great specific questions and you ask them, and she might answer them well, but you might walk out just not feeling that comfortable, but then you might say, well, she answered all my questions right. I think it's more important that you just walk away thinking, I like working with her.
Okay. All right, I just thought I'd see if there was any advice before I get there that I should know, so.
Now, you already ask good questions. You're far enough into this and testing and trying things on your own that I think you're going to be fine. we'll see how well she does. And again, you know, will you walk out of there feeling like that's somebody you want to work with? Because I really think that's the most important thing. The rest of the stuff, you know, will all happen as long as, you know, you two click and there's good communication.
Okay. All right. Well, I'll give you a call later on after the appointment and let you know what happened.
Looking forward to it. Thanks for the follow up on that, and we'll look forward to hearing from you. We'll probably be talking this week on Destination Health. Let's go to, well, you know what? How much time do we have? I want to make sure I've got time. No, you know what? I think I'm going to wrap this show up. I don't have enough time to do this, to do another Called Justice, so, and we will come back next time. It, these hours during the week just fly by. So many questions, so little time, but we'll come back and do it again. In the meantime, check out the website. It's letstruck.com. A couple things I want you to do while you are there. If you are interested in becoming an owner-operator, or if you know somebody who is, do them a favor, do yourself a favor, download my new book. It's available in PDF so you can read it. It's also available in audio book so you can listen to it while you drive down the road. Now, we're giving it away free, but don't think that this is just a couple pages or, you know, something trying to sell you something. This is 50 pages in the PDF and an hour of audio. There's a lot of good information in here. It's all about what not to do, what mistakes to avoid, the six biggest mistakes I see people make when they set out to become an owner-operator. So when you get to the website, letstruck.com, you can't miss it. It's front and center right on the homepage. But also down on the left side of that page is another sign-up form so that you start receiving our newsletter. We have been using our newsletter a whole lot more lately, and I plan on using it a lot this year to give you tips and ideas and resources and let you know what's going on. So check it out. Also, check out the store while you're there and look at the CMC. We'd love to see you this year in May. You can do it all on the website, letstruck.com. We'll be right. Oh, no. We'll be back next time. Thanks for joining me. Be safe. Be profitable, be fit and healthy, always do the hard work, and master the journey. Kevin Dunn. All right, we're going to do another hour here. There we go.
Your money, your taxes, your truck, and your road to success in the trucking industry.
This is Trucking Business
and Beyond,
the show that puts the money where it belongs.
Back in your pocket.
Welcome to my world. I'm your host, Kevin Rutherford. The number to join us, 8888 Road Dog. The website is letstruck.com. The show is all about the business of trucking. We take your calls and answer your questions about trucks, money, fuel mileage, maintenance, tires, taxes, technology, health and fitness on the road, getting started as an owner-operator, finding freight, working with brokers. You name it, we'll tackle it here on this show. All you have to do is pick up the phone and give me a call. You know, many shows I've got an open that I go through, and I love doing that. But sometimes on these hour shows, it just goes so fast. We have so many questions that I like to just get right to them. And I think that's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to jump right into the questions. We're going to start off in Georgia. Jamil, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin, how you doing? I just had a question.
Doing good.
I'm sorry. Yeah,
go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry I haven't done this to your show like I used to because I'm a trainer now. I'm a company driver, by the way, but I'm a trainer. The company I drive for, and a lot of times when your show be on, I be dealing with my students, but I'm free until February the 10th. But so if you touch this topic, and I'm sorry because I missed it, but it's about the glider. But Schneider, I see Schneider now, and they've been selling gliders. I was wondering, have you heard anything about them, or what's your opinion on them, or...
Yeah, absolutely. I think these are a great value. In fact, I think these are one of the best values on the market right now. I love used gliders. The whole glider idea, you know, I've been behind that for years, but not everybody has a budget for a $130,000 glider, and even if you did, it isn't always the best way to go. So finding used gliders has always been something I've recommended, and now that Schneider is turning theirs over, they're available. I think these are great trucks.
Okay, okay. And about, like I said, I'm new, I'm learning. Exactly. How do you come up with your numbers? Like, I know you said for pre-emission engines, you're looking at like 8 to maybe 11 cents per mile maintenance, correct?
Yes.
And for, like, the newer trucks, like I'm in right now, like I'm in a 2014 680, and these are, like, 24 cents. Exactly. Where does that number come from?
Well, it comes we have our software with thousands of users in there, and people call me and ask me to go through their business reports with them. I go in and we group business reports. So these are real numbers from real-world operations.
Okay.
You know, the 11 cents actually is a little high. I mean, when I was running pre-emission trucks just a couple years ago, I kept my maintenance cost on all three trucks, and they were all over a million miles, at under 9 cents a mile. Some years I was at 7. And then I started noticing, you know, my 05, my first emission truck, was running about 13 or 14 cents a mile. And then I started noticing when people would call me with newer trucks and I would go over their business reports, I was seeing 16 and 17. Then when 2012 came around and we started dealing with SCR, I started noticing trucks were getting up over 20 cents a mile. Some of it is you know, shop rates are going up. But the biggest part of it is something simple. You know, I had a caller this week who has a new truck. It was his first week out in a brand new truck, $162,000 truck, and it just shut off on him. And then it would come back on, and then it would shut off. And then finally it derated, and he had to have it towed in, and they spent 3 or 4 hours working on it. Now, a tow bill had to be several hundred dollars. 3 or 4 hours adds up quick at $100+ an hour shop rate, and it turned out to be a fuse. I mean, that kind of stuff never happened on pre-emission trucks, and there's one stupid 30-cent fuse, and his maintenance cost will go through the roof because of that.
Okay, okay, okay. Yeah, like I said, I was wondering exactly what, like, I didn't know if it was a formula you went by to see, like...
No, it's real-world numbers from our software. That's why I love using the software, because we have access to those kind of numbers. So I can tell you, people who believe they're buying a new truck and their maintenance cost is going to be lower, you could not be more wrong. I have the numbers, real-world numbers, to prove it. It is much cheaper to maintain even a million-mile pre-emission truck. I can maintain one of those trucks cheaper than I can maintain a brand-new emission truck. It's crazy. Let's go to Illinois. David, welcome to the program.
Hello, Kevin. I just wanted to comment on an earlier caller in regards to converting over to the ALDs. I am definitely one of the old-time drivers that is refusing to convert. I've been trying, and I'm not going to beat around the bush. I do fudge on my logs because I have two rules that I'm not going to change my operation on, and that is that, and I run a lot of back roads. I do not compete with school buses during their times out there, and I do not go through large metropolitan areas during the peak of rush hour. So what's happening, and I've been running on I think Big Road is one of them that I've been playing with. I've been working with some of the electronic programs, and I can adapt, oh, maybe 50%, 60% maximum. So it's come down to the point where I know that I'm going to have to basically cease operating when I'm by myself. Now, I'm fortunate enough that my wife and I team as much as possible. Now, she's had to take most of this year off to take care of her mother, but team operation, though, we still have the one aspect of that half-hour break that right now we don't worry about it because we drive slow. I'm the one that's got the big custom W9 that I've done all your modifications and so forth, that we get fantastic mileage, and the number one reason is that we drive. I made the mistake of going with 264 gears, so I have to stay at about 58 in order to be in the RPM that I want. So 58 to 60 is where we were on 90% of the time. So we've lost our half hour in the past. And again, I don't beat around the bush. That allows me to decide where I want to drop my line and flag it. When we switch over to ELDs, which we won't have to worry so much about running out of hours or managing our time in that when there's two of us on the truck, but the one thing that I have not figured out the way is that means if we're under a true team run where we're going to be running through the night, and we do entertainment work a lot to where we might have to run nonstop for a day or two. In the middle of the night, I am not about to park myself. I should add, you know, in the middle of the night, it's next to impossible to find a place to park at a truck stop. That coupled with our 320-inch wheelbase, it's going to take us a half hour to get into a parking spot if we do find one. So our only options are going to be park at a fuel island, park on a ramp, or last but not least, park on the edge of a road somewhere. And unfortunately, people may not be aware of it, but we know two people firsthand that have been shot because somebody was breaking into their trucks, you know, while they were sleeping at night. So that has put that on the forefront of paying attention to where we stop at night. I've never, you know, I'm one of those old schools. I used to park anywhere. I used to prefer the isolated spots because of the lack of noise, but I'm having to change my way of operation there. But that's one issue right there that I'm still trying to figure out how we can adapt with the E-log, you know, when we're in a team situation. Like I say, when she has to come off the truck, I'm going to have to come off the truck and just work one of my trucks on a local basis or whatever, because I literally cannot, you know, I only sleep 6 hours at the max, even when I'm at home. So out on the road, I can stop and have good intentions of taking a 10-hour break, but by the time I get up and rolling, I'm already wore out. So
okay, hold that thought. Hold that thought. I'm going to get to a break. We'll come right back, and I'll tell you what I think for whatever it's worth. So stick around.
Okay.
We'll be right back. I'm Kevin Rutt. I'm
Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Before the break, I was talking with David in Illinois about ELD. So, David, let's go over some of this. So, one of the things I've always believed is that most problems can be solved unless we start to put so many conditions on it that we just run out of options. And one of the things you're going to have to do here is start to prioritize, because throughout that whole conversation, you gave me a lot of conditions and a lot of scenarios. You drive slow, which I'm all for. You drive two lane. You don't want to be driving when school buses are out. I understand. I understand all of your conditions. But when you add them all up and then try to apply it in the real world with ELDs, we may have just painted ourselves into a corner. Right. So let's look at them. You know, you don't want to drive through big cities at rush hour. I don't either. I always avoid that. When you're a team, if it's at night, you really don't feel comfortable finding a place to park for a half hour on the break. When your wife's not with you, you don't think you can do the ELDs at all on your own. But you had an option. You go drive local. I mean, you're going to have to sit down and prioritize these conditions and then decide whether or not you are willing to give any of them up if that situation arises, because there are some days where none of these things would cause a problem with your hours. So when it does cause a problem, you know, are you willing to give up any of these conditions or not? And that's totally up to you. I don't care one way or the other, good or bad. It's just we have to face reality. The other possibility, what year is your truck?
Well, I'm blessed in that respect. I have two 91s and a 98 and a 2000. I've just switched over. I'm going to start running the wheels off the 2000, and it will become a parts truck. But I still, I mean, granted, it may go through, but I'm a skeptic, and I just can't see our politicians being that stupid to allow something that simple to stay in effect. Because, you know, if that stays in effect, then we're worrying over nothing. But like I say, I'm a skeptic, and I don't think that mandate will hold.
I think it'll hold. And, you know, it's a gamble to say it either way because we don't know. But I think it'll hold just because most politicians are going to believe that there just aren't that many 90s models trucks left on the road. So I don't think they're going to see this as any big loophole because, come on, we're in 2016. A 99 truck, my God, it's coming up on 20 years old. So I don't think they're going to see this as a big loophole. I think they're going to see, oh, those are old trucks. There's not that many of them left. After a couple of years, they're going to disappear. Why jump through hoops to make the technology more complicated, so to make it backwards compatible? So I think this loophole will hold, the exception. Maybe we shouldn't call it a loophole. The exception will hold. And if it does, then all of your conditions are meaningless because you can just go on doing what you've always done.
Right. Well, I was mainly just making the point that I've already made the decision, and I agree with you, I do have too many conditions, but because I've been driving 41 years, and I'm not willing to change my way. I drive according to my body or road conditions. That piece of paper has no meaning whatsoever to me. So I've already made the decision that I would be coming off the road. I was just calling to make that statement that's why I've tried to adapt and had very little success, because I'm not willing to give up some of those conditions that I've worked into my day-to-day operation.
And I agree with you. That is exactly what I was trying to get across to people is the typical driver is just complaining about this and then saying, if it happens, I'm going to quit. Well, then quit. Go do something else. Hell, I don't care. But if you want to stay in this industry, do what you did. Start trying it now, and then you'll know for sure, and you still have lots of time to see what's going to happen. And maybe you will go local. Maybe you'll retire. Maybe you'll keep an older truck and be one of the exceptions. But you're 2 years ahead of the game already.
Right. Taking one step, which I'm not sure, but it's made a nightmare of my summer. I've got two trucks leased to two different companies, and they're completely two different operations. One I'm gone a month, the other one I'm only gone a couple of days at a time in order to see if this other operation might allow me some flexibility that I'm not normally used to. The problem is it's more like a real job. The truck that we team on is in a power-only operation, so it's a completely different setting than hauling regular freight on a day-in, day-out basis. But the other one, where I'm bumping docks and I'm dealing with brokers, appointment times, that's creating issues of its own, but it has allowed me the opportunity to see if I'm able to adapt to a true 11, 14-hour schedule, that type of thing. And so far, I'm not really having any better results in that operation. But like you say, we've still got time. I'm still going to keep plugging along and see if there isn't some way I can adapt. But my old-fashioned ways of operating are still controlling me.
Yeah, but again, you're trying different things and you're figuring out what might work, what might not. That's the real key here. You know, so many people are going to wait till the end. They're going to wait till they're forced. They're going to be frustrated. They're going to lose a lot of money, and they're not going to have any flexibility or time to work this out. So you're doing the hard work. You're trying it now. You may find something. You may not. Who knows? But you know what you want, and you've got time to try to find it and make it fit what the reality is. Let's go to Nashville. Linda, welcome to the program.
Kevin, thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome. So, what can I help you with?
So I bought this truck. It's a 2012 Cascadia. Bought it a couple years ago. And recently, I had 541,000 miles on it and started coding out of injector problems. And then it derated down to 45 and had to get a tow truck. You know, there's a drill. Spent a week in the shop at Freightliner to get it fixed. I told them, they said, well, it's just coding out as the three. And it's three of them out. And I said, well, go ahead and replace all of them, because first three go out, the other three is not far behind it. And I get to pick up the truck. They only replaced three. I got about 5 miles down the road. The other three went out and had to go back to the shop, get it done again. 1,000 miles later, every time I put my foot on the brake, the low oil pressure light would come on. So I took it to another Freightliner place, and I told him what was going on, and he says, that sounds to me like it's the, I believe he said the pickup tube. He said the Cascadias have been having a whole lot of problems out of the pickup tubes, and if somebody comes in with it while the truck is still under warranty, they'll cover it. But if it's past warranty, it's not covered. And I'm like, well, okay, whatever. Well, if that's what it is, go fix it. So they get into the engine, and I said, you know, while you're doing that, I guess go ahead and do a PM too, because something doing with the oil is kind of freaking me out, so let's just do a PM too. He comes out, he had taken the oil pan off and discovered a whole bunch of plastic and a piece of metal in my oil pan. I mean, he had a handful of it, chunks of plastic. And I said, well, what is that? And he says, I said, well, I took it to my top mechanic, and he said it's the injector harness pieces. The question is, could that stuff do any damage to my motor?
Well, it could. You might have gotten lucky, and it might not have done any. There are a couple things we could do to check. Let me get to a break. The music's playing, and we'll come back, and we'll talk about that and a couple other things. Stick around. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. The website is letstruck.com. Before the break, I was talking with Linda in Nashville. So, Linda, before we get to the specifics about the engine, I want to talk about something else. And people who listen to this show know that I'm pretty big on king responsibility. In fact, I have a pretty drastic approach to this, and that is everything is our fault. Everything's our fault.
Mm-hmm.
I would love to sit here and bash the two shops that really didn't do that great of a job on this. They certainly screwed up. They made a lot of mistakes. But bashing them would do no good because I'm never
right.
going to change them. And that's the norm. We see this stuff all the time. So
right.
in my opinion, you made two huge mistakes here that I always recommend against. And I want to get to those rather than just solve this specific problem because I don't want to see this happen to you again. Do you have any
right.
idea what the two mistakes might have been?
I haven't got a clue. I'm sorry.
Okay. That's okay because then that
buying
means
a Freightliner?
This could be a
no.
teaching. No, not at all. This could be a teaching
I'm sorry.
Moment.
Okay. I'm ready.
Who manufactures the engine that's under the hood?
Detroit.
Yes. I've said this 1,000 times on my show. I never take an engine problem to a truck dealer. I take an
okay.
engine problem to an engine shop. So that means either a factory Detroit shop, because all they do is work on engines all day long, day in and day out. They only go to classes and education
right.
about how to work on engines day in and day out. You pull into a Freightliner dealer, and that guy did an oil change, and then he worked on trying to fix some windshield wipers that wouldn't come on. Then he had to go over and mount a tire. Then he might have been doing an alignment that he knows next to nothing about doing. Then he might have spent a couple hours working on an air conditioning system and recharging it. And then, the first time this week, he's got to solve an engine problem. He's just not good at
right.
it. He doesn't do it enough. He doesn't have enough training in it. And engines, especially engines today, are complicated. So not once, but twice, you took an engine-related
mm-hmm.
problem to a Freightliner dealer. That's mistake number
yeah.
one.
I won't do that
mistake
again,
number,
for sure.
Good, good. Either a factory Detroit engine shop or an independent shop that really specializes in engines, like a Pittsburgh Power, somebody like that. Now, mm-hmm. mistake number two, and I talk about this a lot on my show as well. Do you have a good working relationship with either one of these shops?
No, I don't run that part of the country.
Yeah, so you've got to develop.
I've got good shops
working
down in Georgia and Florida, but I don't. And I was in Indiana, and then I was in Arkansas. And both times I don't run either part of those areas very much.
And I know that can happen, but we really, really need to minimize that. Because I can tell you this. If I would have gone into my shop, shops that I work with, have a relationship with, and I'm talking to anybody in that shop when I bring my truck in, whether I drop it off with the mechanic, the service writer, or the owner of the shop, if I would have told any one of those three guys, put a six-pack of injectors in this, and I came back and they had only put in three, they would have eaten all of the maintenance. They would have eaten all of the maintenance cost to put in the other three. They would have known that was their mistake, and they would have valued the relationship enough to pay for it themselves.
Yeah, and they turned around and charged again for the other three, and I'm standing there throwing
absolutely.
A fit.
Yeah.
And I was like, I would told you to do that the first time. Well, we got to charge you for the injectors. We're not going to charge you for the labor this time. I said, I don't care. You didn't do what you were asked to do.
Well, at least they didn't charge you for the labor. They were actually pretty good about that. Of course they have to charge you for the three injectors. You would have paid for those anyway. So actually you came out of that one pretty good. I thought they would have charged you for the labor the second time. So
no,
you got away with that one pretty good. stay away from truck dealers when it's an engine-related problem. Now, the shop that you're in, and they're doing more work on it, and they're doing a PM, and they said this is the injector wiring harness or the parts of it. Did they? So are those things gone from your current truck, or do they think this happened? They were the old parts.
When he showed me them, he said, this is injector harness pieces. And I said, well, how in the world did those get in my motor? And he's like, well, there's no telling how they got in there. And I said, could it have been from 5,000 miles ago when I had my injectors replaced that something broke off in there? And they, because I don't know, I'm not a mechanic. I don't know anything about replacing injectors. Could they have dropped a part of the injector harness down in there?
Well,
and
they could
have. And I
said, if that being the case, then
that first place should be responsible to pay the bill at the second place because it was the injector harness down in the thing that caused my problem.
Well, what I'm more concerned about at this point is the injector harness and all the parts intact on the engine right now? Has anybody looked?
I'm sorry, say what now?
What I'm concerned about is at that moment, is the injector harness and all the parts on the truck where they belong? Or could these be parts right now? Did anybody go look?
I asked him that, and he said it was all fine, that everything was intact.
Okay.
And then what the irony of it was that I said, I showed him the bill from the first place, and he says, this is really odd because you weren't charged for an injector harness in that job.
Well, I can almost guarantee you, if you did not get charged for an injector harness, they didn't replace one. And if they didn't replace one, maybe these parts aren't from an injector harness. Maybe they're from something else. I am not at all confident in any of the work that's been done or any of the answers you've been given. I would get this truck to the engine shop where you have a relationship with people. Give them the history and let them take a look at this truck.
Okay. Is the only way that an injector harness could get inside the motor, the only way that they could do that was when they did the injector work?
No, that's not the only way. We could have a mechanical malfunction. Something could come loose, and we could end up with parts coming dislodged while the engine's running. The problem here is, I just think we're dealing with really bad information and people that don't know what the hell they're talking about. I would just make it a point to get this truck to a good engine shop, go through the history, and get some good advice on what we need to do from here. Let's go to Illinois. Walt, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. How are you doing? Anyway,
doing great. What's on your mind today?
I've been listening to you for years. It'll be another year before I'm able to get my own truck. But a little over 3.5 years ago, I applied for Landstar, and I was turned down. So I called them up about 4 months ago and talked to the lady, and she says, well, you can reapply once a year. So I went ahead and reapplied and got turned down. Now, I remember that you said that Landstar accepts a small percentage of people, and I don't remember what percent that you said on this one program. Do you know what percent of applicants get accepted to Landstar?
You know, it's been a couple of years since I've got an update on this, but I don't think it's changed very much. When the last time I talked to somebody high enough up that knows that number, it was 3%. Three applications out of every 100 get accepted.
Okay, I don't feel too bad now. I was just wondering, I had a drinking ticket 15 years ago, not in a commercial vehicle. I was thinking, could that be it? Never had a ticket or an accident, so I don't know.
Yeah, that could be. And the other thing is, they really can't say why or why not. That opens them up for all kinds of lawsuits if they were to disclose why or why not they turned down applications. So keep trying. It's really the best advice I can give you. Keep trying. Every market on the calendar and on every anniversary, just apply again. I've got to get to a break. Stick around. We'll be right back. Kevin. Welcome back. I'm Kevin Rutherford. We're down to the final segment. I'm going to get right back to some phone calls. We are off to Virginia this time. Steve, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. I had to call in when you had the caller on the line that was going to set all the conditions for which the government is going to be able to regulate him. I was just, sitting there thinking to myself, wow, I cannot wait till the ELD mandate to come in because I am going to make more money than you can shake a stick at. We're going to have a large percentage of people going to be just like this guy telling everybody what they can't do. And then you got a bunch of us out here that are working under ELOGs now. I can do 3,800 miles a week and I can do 15 stops. I can go on a recap, and I can go on forever like that. I never miss a beat. I don't have any problems doing it. But when you set conditions saying that I'm not going to run when school buses run, I'm not going to run when rush hour traffic is, when I'm not going to do this and I'm not going to do that, you are just limiting what you're going to make in the future. You can go home and you can make $25 an hour for 40 hours a week. Maybe you'll make a $50,000 a year gross pay, and maybe that's enough and that's fine. But for me, I want to maximize what I can within the rules that are there, and the rules are going to change then, and I'm already under them, so I'm going to be in a catbird seat at that point. I'm going to do well, and it's going to. I don't know if you remember, but before they changed the the two 34-hour restarts, couldn't do more than one every 168 hours at the end of 2014, we had a very tight freight market and our rates were through the roof on the spot market. The big carrier said that that change alone was a 2 to 3% difference in efficiencies for them. That was 2 to 3% efficiency, probably gained another percent from all the frack and oil trucks coming out of the oil fields back out here pulling freight. So we're only 3 to maybe 4% more efficient out here than we were in 14, and the rates plummeted on the spot market. They're going to go the other way when we get a 3 to 4 to 5% tightening of the market when all of these folks that have conditions on their work, the way they're going to work, or the way they're going to falsify their logs or whatever, we're going to have that change, and we're all that are out here know how to work are going to be able to make a ton of money at that point. What are your thoughts on that?
I agree. Now, you know, somebody who's been out here doing this 41 years certainly has his way of doing things. He was clear about it. He was clear on how he makes it work now, and he's doing what he has to do. He's 2 years ahead of the game. And if he decides he's not going to work under these conditions, then he's got to figure out some way around it. I applaud him for knowing what he wants, being very clear about it, and working early to figure out some way around it. I'm with you. There are going to be a lot of guys who won't figure this out. There are a lot of guys who are just saying, screw it. When it happens, I'm out of here. So
yeah.
As much as I don't like them, I wish we didn't have all this government regulation. I'm the eternal optimist. It's happening. This is the real world. So let's figure out what's good about it. And you just went over all the things that are good about it.
Yep. And it's going to be, like I say, everybody that's already on them has figured out how to work. Now, there are plenty of people here at Landstar that are on them that haven't figured out how to work them either, how to work within the rules themselves. I mean, everybody has to have, I got to do a 34-hour break. Well, when I'm on the road, I don't want a 34-hour break. You know, I do lots of stops. I'm able to manage my 70 hours. If you can manage your 70 hours, here's one tip for everybody out there. If you work 8 3/4 hours in your logbook every day, that's 8 times 8 3/4 hours is 70 hours. You'll always have 8 3/4 hours you're picking up. You can work forever at that rate and never have to take a 34-hour restart. We did it plenty of times before 2004. I know you did it when you drove because we didn't have resets.
Absolutely.
If they'll just look at it in that regard, they'll make it, you know, change your operation if you have to. Now, if you're going to run straight from New Jersey to Laredo, hammer down, you are going to run out of your 70 hours, but with mine, I like freight that pays better. That's more LTL, more stops, more unloading, things like that. And for me, it works fine because when the truck is stopped, they don't know what you're doing. You know what I mean?
Absolutely. You know that there's nothing wrong with having conditions and knowing what you want. There's nothing bad about that. You also need to have, or you should, if you want to open up the most opportunities, be flexible. So one of the things when I was running under my own authority, I didn't like going to New York City. Very few people do. Long Island, it's not going to happen. But I was flexible enough that I was willing to look at different situations. I wasn't just going to take a random load out to Long Island. It just wasn't worth it. I didn't like going. But because I was open and flexible, I ended up putting together one of my best sort of dedicated runs ever, and I loved it. And it was out to Long Island, but I had stuff going out of right near my home out to Long Island. I would deadhead about 8 miles, pick up another load, and come right back to the house. It was paying really well. And it was only because I was open and flexible enough to do something that I really didn't like to do until you gave me the right situation. Let's go to South Dakota. Brad, welcome to the program.
Hey, Kevin. Thanks for taking my call. Say, I was in my local meat market the other day and was looking to pick up some pork fat, and I came across this stuff called beef, and I don't know if I'm going to pronounce it right, but it's called suet. It's S-U-E-T, I believe is how it's spelled.
Yep.
And what I found out is it's basically unrefined beef fat. What are
Correct.
Some good uses for it? Can I use it just like a lard, or what can I use it, or do I need to refine it down and process it some more, or what's the story
nope.
there?
I have a 5-gallon bucket of that, so I use a lot of beef tallow is another word you will see, suet, tallow. It's basically just fat. We refer to pork fat as lard. We refer to sheep, lamb, and beef fat as tallow and suet. But it all just means fat. I love to fry in beef tallow because the flavor is amazing, and it's one of the most stable oils because it's so saturated, and you don't get a lot of oxidative damage to it when you fry in it. The funny thing is, or actually it's kind of tragic, fast food restaurants used to do their French fries in beef tallow. And if you remember 30 years ago, McDonald's French fries were amazing, and not so much anymore because then they went to trans fats and now they use polyunsaturates. And it turns out they're far more unhealthy for us. We really should be frying in beef tallow, and it tastes better. So I do not a lot of deep frying, but I love wings, some other things that are deep fried, and I use beef tallow for that. I use beef tallow for sauteing. It's just a really good cooking fat. Now, here's the thing. If I'm going to use fat like that, I buy 5-gallon buckets of grass-fed beef tallow. The traditional factory farmed animals, it would still be a good stable fat, but the omega-6 to omega-3 ratio won't be very good. So if you can buy it, and you can buy it in small jars, grass-fed. I get some on Thrive Market, and it's a great cooking fat. If you're going to deep fry, then I just like to get it in bigger quantities.
Okay, yeah, I was just thinking about, you know, just kind of using it like I do butter, just kind of change things up a little bit, you know, like maybe cook a steak or something in it. You know, I got a lot of electric pan
yep.
in the truck here I like to cook with, so just throw a little
yep,
bit
absolutely.
Of that in there, fry
so,
up some onion and stuff in there and
yeah.
cook up my steak with it.
Yep, it is a great cooking fat. So right in front of my cooktop, I have got tallow, lard, ghee, which is clarified butter, and brown butter. I mean, those are the fats I cook in. And like you said, I just rotate through them to change things up. But those are all good cooking fats.
Perfect. And then you said at Thrive Market I can get the grass-fed. Is that going to be a bigger – how much of a price difference would that be from the conventional? Because I'm sure that's what I grabbed was conventional because it didn't say grass-fed on it. But I thought it would
yeah,
be a little
you know,
better
grass,
than, you know.
The grass-fed is a little more – but if you get it at Thrive Market, it's about the best price you're going to find. So the music's playing. I've got to wrap this up and get out of here. We will see you next time. Thanks for joining me. Be safe, be profitable, be fit and healthy, always do the hard work, and master the journey. Kevin Rupp. All right, everybody, thanks for joining us. We'll see you back here tomorrow.